Well, I'm excited to have Dershan Sani here on the Will's Way podcast today. He's been one of the key people that I knew that I wanted to get on really early. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Brandon. I look forward to obviously having this conversation today. And real estate's our thing. So
it sure is. Yeah, my friends like to say that I'm a real estate junkie.
We all are.
And you want to hang around people that have similar interests, and you definitely do. So why don't you introduce yourself to our guests, kind of tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and kind of what your main focus is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I grew up in Elkhart, Indiana, went to Purdue for engineering, worked in the RV industry, automotive industry, and aerospace industry. Most recently, I was working at Rolls-Royce. I started investing in real estate in 2013. I quit my job in 2016 to focus full-time on real estate. Quit my professional engineering job in 2016 to focus on real estate full time. I started to get a little bit deeper involved in real estate, and I got a broker's license. And a lot of my friends were asking me to invest or helping them invest in real estate. So, with the broker's license, I started doing that, and then they started asking, "Well, who's going to manage all these properties?" So I started a property management company, and then eventually I was interested in the movement of money, so I got a loan origination license. So I was able to finance properties as well. So fast forward to 2022, I guess. I still run a property management company. We manage about 500 units. I continue to invest in real estate. I have ownership in about 225 units, and also still run a brokerage. I don't do loan origination anymore, but so that's kind of where we're at right now. Real estate's been a great journey. Have enjoyed every bit of it and continue to enjoy every bit of it. Wake up every morning and still feel excited, kind of, going to the office and working on real estate stuff.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Like, you hit on it a little bit perfectly. Like, there's a lot of different avenues within real estate that you could really be focusing on.
Yeah, it's endless.
It is endless. I think that's what's unique about real estate is you don't just have to be niche down so much to where you're only doing being a broker. You're only being a PM. What would you say when you first started buying your assets, when you first left your W-2, would you say, did you envision yourself doing any third party at all?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I never really thought, in fact, not only just third party property management, but didn't really even, would have never thought that I'd be this deep in real estate, I suppose. I started investing in real estate primarily for passive income, like a lot of people do. And then because I was self-managing my properties and I started helping other people invest in real estate, I think property management part of it just kind of came fairly naturally in a way. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how that got started, and that's how I got involved in that piece of the business. But like you said, I mean, there's literally a gazillion different things that one can be doing in real estate. I think it's just you have to pick and choose what you want to be doing.
Awesome. So how long ago did you decide that you wanted to get into real estate to a point that you could leave your W-2 job? Because, I know people who come from a similar background, engineers at these highly respected companies, and they have a goal of like, hey, in 5, 7, 10 years, I want to be able to do what you did. Where do you think the motivation came from being able to do it as quickly as you did?
Yeah. So, interestingly, in 2012, I started thinking about the fact that I wanted to leave my W-2 job. So I started exploring different possibilities and different avenues to make that happen. So I probably explored every single business under the sun, subways, hotels, motels, Dunkin' Donuts, manufacturing service, export, import, and eventually kind of settled onto real estate. And so when I started buying real estate in 2013, single family homes and small multifamily at the time, I thought it probably would take about 10 years to quit my job and kind of have sufficient amount of passive income from real estate to be able to quit the job. So I think, I kept going, obviously, right? Started investing in 2013, kept going in 2014 and 2015 and 2016. The last property that I bought in the beginning of 2016, I knew that was going to be kind of my ticket out of Rolls-Royce, so to speak. And I guess the big question is that how did it take less than 10 years, which was my original estimate? I think a couple things, right? So timing was right. And, as you well know, there were different deals available in 2013 to through 2016, all the way into 2018, even 2019, than what's available right now in 2022, or especially what was available in 2020 and 2021. So I think timing was right, and I was able to, you know, get some deals and really, you know, give you one deal, particularly an example. There was a property available for, I think the listing price was $775,000, okay. 22 units in Greenwood. And I had said, you know what, according to my numbers, I think I can offer 770. And I did, and they accepted. And, you know, on the day of closing, I remember looking at the closing statement. I realized a broker made like almost $50,000 commission in that deal.
Yeah.
Because he took both sides of the commission and all that. And I was like, wow, that's, I think I overpaid. But then, you know, fast forward, what, just 5-6 years later, and that property is more than, you know, has 15,000 plus monthly rent. So, you know, things kind of worked out in the end. I think largely I would say timing and availability of capital, like financing opportunities, right? So, you know, you had banks willing to finance multifamily. You had obviously, you know, a bunch of these agencies like Freddie and Fannie, as well as HUD. They're very open to financing multifamily real estate during the time that I talked about, I think.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've always liked about like how you operate, and it probably had something to do with allowing you to grow as well, is like you're like me, like you always want to find a way to do something the most efficient way possible, but also very economical way. And you're not scared to think outside the box when you're looking at something and not saying, well, it's always been done this way. So yeah. I'm just going to continue to do that.
Yeah, property management and operating real estate is very open to kind of new ideas and new ways of doing things, I think, all the time.
Yeah, I think it is. Like, if you would say, looking back on your growth to 500 units with a combination of owning and third-partying, what are some of the efficiencies that you've identified and added to really streamline your business?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So I think up until I had about 89 units, I didn't actually have a property management software.
Okay.
So I got that. And then, you know, one of the things that I always say, and I've realized, you know, to its very core, is that I wish I had gotten that much sooner. And I think that goes with just about everything, that I wish that some of the systems that I'm getting now, that I wish I'd gotten it sooner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, investing money in software and tools and systems and technology, I think that's come a long way. That's helped us out quite a bit in sort of making things more efficient, more effective. Being able to pull the weight of 500 properties with less number of people, I think that's worked out pretty well. You know, there's many things that come to mind. One thing that comes to mind, I suppose in particular, is since last about 1 year, we've had an offsite employee, and he basically works 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, just like all of us in the office here in the U.S. do. But he's based in India, and, you know, there's a, you know, significant cost differential. And, you know, the way I think of it sometimes is that, you know, we have to call utility companies and wait on the phone, waiting for someone to pick up the phone on their end. And I'd rather have him do that from India, where the, you know, per hour cost is a lot less, versus having someone else hold on the phone here from our office. It would make a big difference. So a lot of kind of admin back-end office things, like, you know, entering bills, bookkeeping, accounting, those types of things, you know, paying bills, you know, changing out utilities. So a lot of things like that, you know, we have someone that does it from India, from on the back end of it. So that's worked out really well. I think we've also kept like this kind of a really one big office, so to speak, mm-hmm. where everybody kind of works from the same spot. So there's a sense of osmosis almost, that, you know, the communication is very easy, very streamlined. It's also, you know, honestly, save some money in office space to some extent. So I think some of these are things that come to mind when you think about, like, you know, efficiencies. And I think maybe not just property management and not just real estate. I think every small business in America probably has to think about these things, that how do you make it make sense, I suppose.
I think you touched on a good point. I feel like in a post-COVID environment, as labor becomes harder to find, but the labor that you do find is becoming more and more expensive, Looking ways to maybe outsource some of those admin tasks that don't necessarily need a body in the office to do make a lot of sense. And I know a lot of people who are going into that direction, because if you've been in real estate long enough, we all have a love-hate relationship with those utility companies.
Yes.
I directly call, a few months back where I was on hold for over 4 hours.
Wow. That would drive anyone insane, I think. Yeah.
For the water company. So here I am trying to still do my daily work while I have the ringtone going on in the background.
Yeah.
For someone to answer. And at the end of the day, is that the best use of our time as business owners? Yeah. It's not. So I think that's really creative about trying to find a way to still make sure that the work is done at a high level, but maybe have some of that overhead and cost kind of outsourced to a lower expense line.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now that you are kind of in a more of like a stabilized environment between the stuff that you own and the stuff that you manage, where do you kind of see the next 3 years? What's the next 3 years look like for Gershon with all the market changes that are going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I kind of wish I knew the answer to that. Yeah. So I really don't. I suppose I can guess just like anyone else can. I think for us, the next 3 years will involve more of acquisitions and acquisitions by way of syndication and then taking over the management, proving to the investors that we can do the same amount of kind of heavy lifting at a reasonable cost for them as well as what we have done for ourselves.
Of course.
Right. So I think that's probably what the next 3 years look like. I think we're probably a little less focused on third-party management, but probably a little bit more focused on acquisition of multifamily properties, with syndication, having a stable or stabilized property, stabilized capital group. So that's, I have all the pieces in place. It's just a matter of looking for deals and finding properties that make sense.
Yeah.
On the purchase. And because, multifamily has been so intensely competitive to get to in the last 6 to 8 months, we've started to look at retail and other commercial assets that might also make sense. So we'll see how that goes. But like I said, I definitely like multifamily properties. I like residential real estate. I like the both the stability of it and then the operational intensity of it. It's not like a triple net lease, right? You have tenants, you have residents, and you have kind of a day-to-day operation that's significantly different from what a commercial property operation looks like. Like a retail property operation looks like. So I do like both sides of it. So let's see. I think, it's a matter of just being able to find a property that makes sense.
And being nimble enough to, if you have a plan of maybe looking at more multi, but you can't, being able to pivot into another real estate class. I think for us is when I first started with Wells Way, it was all about, hey, what is my superpower? I've been doing third-party property management for my entire career. But now that I'm in it from a business owner, it's almost to the point where post-COVID, our operational challenges have definitely increased. Our operational expenses have increased.
Costs have gone up quite a bit, huh? Yeah.
But then when you're looking at your client profile that you work with, you really want to be... I'm going to be careful here, you want to be careful. Like, you want to make sure that you're aligning yourself. If your plan is to grow more third party, you want to be very picky with the clients that kind of share your kind of philosophy on where expenses should be. Because it's one of those things to where clients or investors who think that, they want to make millions of dollars off this asset over 3 years. And their PM is the one really driving that value, but they want to keep lowering the amount of fees that PM collects. And I think it has to be a good balance between having an equal value exchange and a shared partnership mindset versus, hey, we're the owner, you're the third party property manager. Do it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think there are a lot of owners who have a very much kind of a partnership mentality. And I think, I think everyone generally kind of broadly understands in the industry that property management is like the tip of the spear, right?
Yes.
it's where the money's made or money's lost, and that's where, you know, you either do really well and everybody profits and benefits, or you screw up and everybody suffers, right? So I think that generally there's a broad realization in all investors that, you know, you have to have someone that can make the operations good enough that you can actually run your performas, right? Mm-hmm. what you predicted, you know, 5 years ago and 3 years ago and 4 years ago, that has to come to fruition by virtue of kind of practice in property management, right?
No, it does. Yeah. No, I think so. You know, for me, it's more about we can't materialize the processes and
yeah.
systems out of thin air that can go generate and push rents and streamline expenses for our clients.
Yeah, and I think property management is kind of one of those. I mean, in general, residential real estate operations are unique in some sense because I think technology has changed a lot of it, mm-hmm. but I think some part of the human interaction is likely to not go away anytime soon. I think eventually it might, like maybe 30, 40 years down the road, but in the near future, I think 5, 10, 15 years, I don't think that interaction is going to go away because, you know, the amount of human issues that we deal with in property management, I just can't imagine that all of those things can be addressed with technology.
No, I think you hit on an amazing point. There's this big drive post-COVID to really drive the technology that we're seeing come out, the drive the call centers and all that. I think those are all great ideas, but you can't really remove the human element out of it.
Not completely. Yeah.
If you have a resident who's upset with what's going on in their four walls,
yeah.
Let's be honest, the amenities are nice at some of these places, but the tenants usually only care about their four walls. Yeah. They want someone that they can see face to face and attribute to all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
What we see from an operational standpoint is one of the biggest challenges that you're having to overcome right now. Is it labor? Is it materials for unit turns or renovations? Lack thereof, supply chain issues. What would you say is some obstacles that you're?
Yeah, I mean, hey, it was sort of all of the above, right? I mean, yeah. I mean, I think everyone's kind of seen the same thing that we're seeing, which is that, you know, there's not enough people out there. There's not sometimes. I mean, I think the supply chain issues are largely resolved. I mean, you know, because costs have gone up, right? I mean, because there were supply chain issues, costs have gone up, and those increased costs haven't gone down, even though a lot of the supply chain issues have been resolved. So we have materials that we can buy. It's just, you know, they're more expensive. Yeah. So I think, yeah, I would say probably labor is the number one concern. I think generally what's happened over the last, I would say maybe, you know, since late 90s, right, is that people in America have somehow put this whole idea that working with your hands is not as prestigious a thing to do.
Yeah.
It's not sexy. It's not as prestigious a thing to do. You know, punching on keyboard and producing emails is the way to make money and is the right thing to do. Is the more prestigious thing to do. So you have a lot less people in the labor pool who can actually, you know, fix a water heater or fix a furnace or install a furnace or, you know, do plumbing or do electrical. So, you know, and I think, and not just real estate, but I mean, I think I read the other day that we're short like 80,000 truck drivers in America. So I think in real estate, kind of similar, right? That pretty soon you're going to run into a scenario in which you have just, and I think we already have run into it, that you have a lot less number of people who can, you know, repair plumbing or repair electrical issues. So, and then the kind of, you know, unfortunately, I hate to say it this way, but like sometimes the type of people go into that are the ones that, okay, well, they didn't have a lot of choice doing anything else. So they kind of decided to just picked up a phone one day and say, well, I can do electrical repair, but they really can't.
Yeah.
So you want quality people who can show up on, exactly. Yeah. They watched a bunch of YouTube videos and they say, oh, I can fix an electrical issue. Yeah. So I think you want people who are quality people, you know, you want reliable people that are going to show up on time and do the job on time. So I think that's kind of number one struggle, which, you know, I think up until now, we still can find them. But my concern is that, you know, maybe 15, 20 years down the road, I think either we have to place a higher economic value on those trades, right? Like someone who's an electrician or HVAC repair tech or maintenance tech in general, their economic value has to be much more than what it is now. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think we'll lose some of those skills.
No, definitely. I think from a multifamily residential property management perspective exclusively, is COVID did a really good job of showing what's vital to the operations of a multifamily asset. And we could do a lot of the office stuff from home.
Yeah, we could, but you can't repair stuff at someone else's apartment from home.
100%. You can't go replace that toilet from home. So I think there's been this renewed appreciation for the men and women who are on the maintenance side of things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, right when COVID started in March, everyone kind of went home, right? I mean, March of 2020. And I remember that there was like a steep drop in maintenance requests, right? Because no one wanted anyone to come to their house. But even during that first couple of weeks, there were issues with like people's water heater and people's furnaces and people's power supply. And then they would still put in a maintenance request. And we still ended up sending someone, even like on March 20th of 2020, right? When the fears were perhaps at its peak and there was a lot of kind of information that was just not available, or rather you could say misinformation about COVID or whatever. But nonetheless, I mean, at the end of the day, we had to still send people in other people's homes, and they wanted them to come in because at some point, I mean, people wanted to ask the question, and they had to ask the question that, am I going to live without furnace, or am I going to live with the potential risk of COVID, right? So I think they just put the mask on. We requested our maintenance techs to put a mask on. But I think you're right that the whole idea of doing maintenance in the apartment industry or the residential real estate industry, I think that got a different level of importance put on it during COVID.
It did, yeah. And so as a small business owner whose primary focus was property management right at the beginning of COVID, it was tough. It was tough.
I can imagine.
I remember spending 4 or 5 hours a day on webinars from NMHC, IREM, and NAA on I felt like the best practices were changing like every single day. And I didn't have a huge team. So here I am trying to run my business while also being
also trying to figure out what everyone else is doing.
Exactly. So I really think that obviously COVID is bad. It was bad and still bad, but I think that it did some things to our industry specifically. Mm-hmm. More so, I think from a technology standpoint, I think it accelerated what we have to use at our disposal.
It definitely did. Years. And also, I mean, it accelerated the adoption of technology on the part of tenants also, right? On the part of residents. I think, you had a lot more number of people who were much more open to paying rent online, putting maintenance requests online. We literally had no one show up to the office for like 6 months, right? I mean, obviously now things have changed and people start to show up to the office again. And, people come sometimes even pay their rent at the office. But up until maybe about 6 months ago, that had completely stopped. So I think the adoption of technology on the part of the residents also changed.
Yeah, and that's something that, we can, as operators, we can adapt as much technology as we want. If we don't get that buy-in from the residents, we're just beating our head against the wall trying to go through all these hoops. Being an investor yourself, being a property manager, you have a really, really good pulse on the market and where rents currently are and where they may go. What are your thoughts on rents? Do you think that they're overinflated right now and they're going to kind of keep going up? Do you think we've kind of hit that ceiling and they'll probably stabilize? And I'll give you my thoughts after I hear yours.
Okay, sure. So I think, what I'm seeing, right, and it may be different from what other people are seeing, what I see is that I think the apartment rents will go up at a certain rate. But I think the single family home rents are going up faster.
Yes, they are.
I'll give you two examples. One, we had a house that was rented at $1,000. Just, I think, April of 2022, when their lease was over, and March, and the new lease, we gave them a $300 rent increase. So it was $1,300. And I thought, sure as heck, that person is going to say, well, I'm out. I'm going to find somewhere else to live. And they did not. They re-signed a lease at 30% rent increase. And almost, exactly same situation, 950 to 1250. So we could do that on the single family. I don't think we could do that on apartments. I think we could probably do maybe 8, 10% on the high end. We also don't have Class A apartments. I think what we manage largely is, own and manage is largely between, I would say, Class B and Class C. So I think there we're able to do maybe 7 to 10%. But I think the apartment rents are probably not going to go up like that every single year, right? I think you'll probably see them go back down to like somewhere between 3 and 5% from where they the growth is, you know, closer to like 8% right now, 8, 10%. And this is, you can think of it as a word from the street that, you know, this is what I'm seeing. I have not read a ton of articles in terms of, you know, I've seen a ton of articles. I've seen the headlines that basically say rents have gone up. And I see them. I mean, I see the rents have gone up for sure, especially when I look back to like 2018, 2019. I think rents have significantly gone up. I just don't see them continuing to go up that way for the next 2 or 3 years. I think what the government's trying to do with increasing the Fed fund rate, and, you know, by extension, the 10-year treasury is going up, and I think it's going to have an impact on everything, including rent growth. So that's my two cents for what it's worth.
No, I think you hit on some really good points there. I'm also seeing single family is seeing some really aggressive growth. You know, I have friends who are doing 30, 40. Sometimes even 50%.
Oh, wow.
Increases.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. We haven't done that yet.
It's one of those things where just lack of inventory is either doing, it's doing a few things. It's allowing us as operators to supply demand, increase rents, because there's no product. But it's also putting the residents in a spot where are they going to go? And that's when, like, we have to be mindful of that. So we're real big on making sure that the tenant is loving where they're at. So it's easier to absorb that 30-40%.
Yeah, and in this business, I mean, a lot of it boils down to relationships, right?
100%, yeah.
It's a relationships with the contractor. It's a relationships with the maintenance people. It's a relationship with the residents. It's a relationships with your employees. So I think the one piece that I think often gets overlooked or not maybe given the due importance is the relationships with the residents itself. You know, in both the cases that I just talked about, I mean, we knew the residents well enough, and we also didn't want to push it beyond that.
Yeah.
Could we have? I think we potentially could have. Mm-hmm. But I think we want to stay on sometimes on the reasonable side of things so that, you know, that we're not turning more often than we need to and all of that. So I think there is a fine balance between pushing rent growth and then, you know, turning at every single lease renewal, right?
Yeah. No, so for us, I think that's where we would probably differ the most from a philosophical standpoint, because we're also 30, 35% on rent increases on our multifamily.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so like in the last 90 days, our lowest rent increase was 175.
Wow.
A month.
Wow, maybe we need to rethink what we're doing then.
our highest was 415.
Wow.
Now, that is an outlier. That was one.
Sure.
They had been there for a long time. That was our highest.
And the tenant didn't leave?
Correct. They stayed.
They stayed. Wow.
They stayed.
That's extraordinary.
And kind of what allows us to do that is we quantify everything that we do. And it's one of those things to where if that resident wants to move out because of the rent increase, and let's just say for a standard turn, it's $2,500, painting, flooring,
sure,
a few repairs.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the new resident moving in is at a $300
increase.
That's a return in less than a year. But let's do it.
Yeah, so we've seen the same thing, that every single turn that we've done for rent increase, it's always been like 7-8 months payoff.
Mm-hmm. So, but it's also one of those things, like, I think my personal opinion on multifamily rents is we haven't hit a ceiling yet. Because what interest rates, I believe, are going to do is, it's not really going to affect the rent renters as much, but it's going to stop development. Right? It's going to slow down construction development because now the cost of that loan is higher. The cost of the supplies are higher. So we're already at a massive
shortage
of product that, you know, I'm not a big market person. I rely on other people for that knowledge, and I do my own research. But construction companies typically at a high inflationary period get hurt pretty bad from the short-term loans. So if we have product that's being halted or slowed.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those things that as feeling like we have as much good of a pulse on rents, it's hard to sit here and say that we know what that ceiling is.
Yeah.
And for someone to say, well, the ceiling on that 3-bedroom, 1-bath and 46226 zip code is X. How do you know that? Like, are you trying to push past that? Are you putting your own?
Yeah. And it, it depends on what your finish level is and all that kind of stuff too. Right. So I think, no, I think you're right. I don't think you're far off the mark. I think people just don't know. I think we don't know. I think, economists and people who study this stuff all day long, I think they have some ways of doing the analysis, but I'm not so sure that all of those things are just accurate.
Yeah, no, I mentioned this on a previous episode of the podcast, but I was in Colorado for the Best Ever Conference.
Sure, yeah.
And the economist for CBRE and then Marcus Milchap, they've both put on a presentation. And I thought they were going to be conservative, kind of doom and gloom, be cautious. And they came out and were like, basically, it's not going to affect you. Buy. Both of them.
Yeah.
From competing mindsets. So I definitely thought that was interesting. Do you think people have over-leveraged the last couple of years? buying at 4% cap rates. And then now interest rates are pushing.
Like five plus. Yeah.
5+.
Yeah, I don't know that people have over-leveraged, but I think it remains to be seen what happens in the next, I would say more like, not like 6 months, but like 12 to 24 months or maybe even longer. Because I heard a number the other day, and I'm not so sure if where it came from, but that in 2021, a good 70% of real estate transactions were done with bridge loans.
Okay.
So which means, these bridge loans are going to come due typically in 3 years. So, when you're in 2024, if the interest rates are still as high as what they are right now, and if the NOI hasn't gone up in accordance with both the rates as well as, the buyer's expectations, right? So if it hasn't gone up, then the buyers, the current owners of those properties will have to bring more money to the table in order to put permanent financing on those properties. Because most of these loans are obviously debt service constrained loans, mm-hmm. which means if the NOI hasn't gone up, it's not going to have the amount of loan proceeds that they were looking for, and that means that just in order to put permanent financing on it, they'll have to put money on the table. Yep. So that scenario could potentially create distress, but I don't see that's happening for next at least 24 months, right? I mean, people would have put a bridge financing on acquisitions in 2020, and which is also not coming up due until 2023.
Correct.
So I think you're still a little ways away from potentially seeing any kind of distress at all. And plus, like you said, because there's such a shortage of housing, if the rent keeps going up, if the rent growth keeps up and if the net operating income pushes up, then they'll get the loan proceeds as they had anticipated anyways. So the moving pieces of this equation, right, are rent growth, net operating income. Because just along with rent growth, there's also expense growth.
There are, yep.
Right, which a lot of people, I think people generally accommodated expense growth, but maybe not to the extent that it is happening.
Wait, so you mean that we can increase the income, but we can't lower the expenses.
Exactly.
We get asked that a lot. Like, hey, you need to actually scale with each other.
Yeah, so the typical hope or the strategy is that you increase rents at a faster rate than you increase the expenses.
Correct.
Right. So let's say you're increasing rents at like 4% or 5% or 10%. The expense escalation is less than that, and that's how you increase the net operating income, right? So that's one way that everybody kind of hopes to make money in the industry. The scenario that we're gonna go into is that will the net operating income growth be eaten up by interest rate growth? Yep. So between these three numbers, right, you've got rent growth, expense growth, net operating income, and interest rates. I think weather determines the loan proceeds on a property are in line with the owner's expectations when they go to put permanent financing on. That's when you'll know whether they've over-leveraged or not, yeah. Right? Because leverage is kind of funny. I mean, they put 20% down at the time of purchase, but the leverage is really determined when they try to put a permanent financing on it or try to refinance a debt.
One thing that concerns me is I'm seeing operators who will do a bridge loan, and then they'll come in and they'll call segregate the asset, front-load their depreciation.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not taking those savings from the interest-only period, not having to pay the principal, or not taking the savings from tax and putting it back into the asset to increase the
value of the asset.
They're distributing that cash amongst their investors, and I'm like, how are they going to be able to increase the NOI enough to
offset the?
And it's almost like you distributed some of that cash during the duration of the IO period, but now they're going to have to bring that cash back to put a long-term agency debt on the asset.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are some nuances which are you know, unique when you take on agency debt, right? Like, for example, if there's a bridge loan, they don't have this laundry list of requirements in terms of what your insurance has to be. Once you put an agency debt, you know, they'll give you a list of requirements, right? So your insurance requirements are higher. Your cost of insurance is higher. Then they do annual inspections, so then your upkeep might be higher, right? Yeah. Well, higher than what it might have been otherwise. So I think there are certain costs associated with the good financing and good debt that's out there. So that's also part of the puzzle. I think when someone takes on a bridge loan, is not necessarily accounted for,
correct?
Right, because it's hard to account for. It's just hard to account. And you know, the other thing is, you know, because of the inflation, I would imagine that cost of operations of all levels of governments are going up, right? Like, I mean, whether you're talking about state government, city government, county government.
Yep.
And one of the ways they fill that gap is by increasing property taxes, right? So that's likely to go up. I mean, if not in the immediate term, I would say next 24 months or so.
Yeah.
Because by the time they realize the amounts of deficits and they try to cover that up with, you know, like, for example, I would imagine property tax funds, I believe, education, right? Like schools and things like that. You know, if the school teacher salaries and operating expenses for those schools are going up, I mean, that money's going to have to come from somewhere, right?
It will, yeah. And I want to hit on underwriting a little bit, because that's where all this stuff can be figured out.
Comes together.
You know, in the beginning, what are some ways that you stress test your deals when you're doing your basic initial underwriting?
Yes, so, I mean, you know, one is obviously we stress test according to occupancy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, say, you know, there's significant job losses and occupancies are going to go down, so we stress test on that. We stress test on an increase of expenses. Things like property tax, things like insurance, things like maintenance. So I think those are the things that we stress test on. I think because a lot of our acquisitions were prior to COVID or literally just prior to COVID, we only did, I think, three major acquisitions during COVID.
Okay.
So we didn't really have to think too hard about stress testing prior to COVID, because I think the deals were good enough on their own. There was a lot of buffer. You know, you could potentially operate, you know, reasonably profitably, even at like 80% occupancy.
Correct.
And occupancies have been high. So I think largely one of the things that people just haven't seen, the current lot of operators, including myself, is a low occupancy environment.
Yeah.
Right? Like an environment in which, like, you just don't have good paying tenants. Like, we've always had good paying tenants. I mean, I've been doing real estate since 2013 pretty aggressively, and we've never run short of good paying tenants, right?
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that we've, from a delinquency standpoint, is when we take over management and we have some of those inherited tenants that maybe didn't go through our screening process.
Oh, yeah.
We struggle common with problem. That a little bit. But so some other ways that we stress test or help our clients stress test their deals too is, like, we who knows what the exit cap rate is going to be, right? If you're trying to forecast 3, 5, 7 years down the road, you know, so, like, it's, is the cap rate going to go up half a basis, a full basis point?
Yeah, and places like Indiana, I mean, or you know, Middle America, I think cap rates are always going to be higher than the prevailing interest rate, right? So I think, you know, you saw a 4% cap rate environment in Indiana, but I don't think that's happening anymore because, you know, interest rates are over 5%.
I was shocked to learn that within the last 90 days, we have seen on, this is much larger multifamily assets, but we have seen some sub 4 cap rate closings.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think if it's as early or, you know, as late as January of this year, I think I can understand because yeah. I think those are still at kind of the low interest rates. They've gone up significantly since then. So I'd be curious to see if you, going forward for the rest of 2022, if you see trades happening at 4% cap rate in Indiana.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to be able to get a good commercial broker on in the next few episodes.
I'd be curious about that. I will listen in.
we all know they're going to come in and say, oh yeah, cap rates are going down to, we'll probably see 3.25 cap rate this year. Which is a running joke with one that I know from last year. And then interest rates, like where do you see the interest rates landing at? I know inflation is around what, 8% right now. Do you think interest rates are going to get that high this year or within the next 2 years?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think if I knew the answer to that question, I probably wouldn't be doing this. You know, I'd be doing something a lot different and making a lot more money, I suppose. But, I think it's a big question. I don't see that interest rates going to 8%, but I think we're a little over what, 5.25
right now is the last quote I saw.
Yeah, like on a lot of the agency debt. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there are banks that are still doing sub 5, like, you know, 4.4, 4.5. So I think we're probably still looking, it's probably still going to go up another percent, like, you know, 100, 150 basis points.
Okay.
I mean, and I know that based on just reading the newspapers, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't have any other kind of, you know, additional information than what everybody else has.
How do you feel that real estate does in a high inflationary period? Because I think it's one of the better assets that you could put your money in. My mentor tells me this story about 100 years ago, you could walk into a suit shop with a $20 gold piece. That $20 gold piece could buy that suit. $20 bill could buy that suit. You go into that same suit shop today, $20 gold piece can buy that suit. $20 cannot buy that suit. So it all comes back to
what's going
to
hold a better value, exactly. Yeah, longer term, yeah.
In investing your money in non-dollar denominated assets.
Yeah.
And real estate falls in that category.
Yeah, absolutely it does. I think, I think as long as you're not speculating, right? As long as you're not like, well, I invested in 2020 and I sold it in 2021 and I made this much money.
Exactly.
And you're not expecting to buy it in 2022 and sell it in 2023 or 2024 and say, well, I wanted to kind of double my money or triple my money. As long as you're not speculating, I think as long as you're in the game for long term, you're buying assets based on its rental income and hoping for, you know, kind of having the strategy that it's going to appreciate at a certain amount over next whatever number of years. Or, you know, it's going to at least hold its value against inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So let's say there is 8% inflation. It's going to appreciate at probably 10%. So it's going to do a little bit better than just, you know, if you had kept it in raw dollar amounts and we're getting interest rate of, say, inflation amount. So I think that's a commonly accepted wisdom in real estate. Right. And in general investing world that if you're trying to hedge against inflation, then real estate is a good bet. You see, a lot of people aren't just trying to do that, though.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're in the capital preservation mode, you have a lot of money and all you need to do is make sure that the money doesn't disappear, then that makes a lot of sense. But then if you're in the capital growth mode, then sometimes real estate being where it's at, I think you have to really give it some thought that the deal that you're getting, it actually makes sense for capital growth. So I think those are the things that a lot of investors will have to ask themselves before they, you know, jump with both feet into a deal. And I think real estate's a pretty stable bet you know, whether you're trying to preserve the capital or trying to grow the capital. So, yeah.
But kind of as we wrap up here, I feel like one of my goals for this podcast is to be able to connect with people who are a little bit more sophisticated, but also connect people who are interested into getting into real estate, because it's the popular thing to do right now is to get into real estate. So, and you're uniquely equipped, Pete, to offer advice from an investor, but also as an operator. So first, as an operator, for someone starting out with no experience, what's one piece of advice that you would give to them?
I'd say stay with it, right? I mean, a lot of times, you know, real estate's kind of one of those things that it's tougher to get into because of, you know, the capital requirements and financing and building a network of people and all of that. There's a ton of things that make real estate sometimes a little harder to get into. And sometimes what happens is I've seen people will buy 1, 2, 3, 4 houses, and then they'll be like, "Oh, this is too much work," and they go do something different.
Yeah.
So I think stay with it a little bit longer, right? Don't switch so easily and don't switch so soon. So if you stay with it long enough, I think real estate is a way to really build wealth and grow capital and grow wealth as well. I think if you look at lives of very wealthy people, somewhere in their life, they had a sizable interest in real estate. Most of them actually continue to have a sizable interest in real estate. And I think that story can be anyone's story as long as they stay with it.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And then that's from an operator's perspective. From an investor, they don't know their hand from their feet. What are some resources that you think are out there right now that make sense for a beginning investor to explore?
I mean, there is a ton of resources out there right now. You know, obviously, there's all kinds of forums and podcasts and YouTube videos and influencers who are trying to encourage people to get into real estate.
Yeah,
exactly. There's a ton of investing advice out there in real estate. And not all of that advice is great, but not all of that advice is bad either. I mean, a lot of that advice is really good too. So I think when someone's trying to invest, I think if they're younger, I think they can just literally do house hacking, right? You know, buy a house, rent the rooms out. You know, if they have a family, they can start with one, right? Now, I always say that even for the most enthusiastic beginner real estate investor, buy one property or get involved in something and then run it for 6 months, right? Run it for a year and see whether you like it, see whether it's for you or not. And I think especially, I would say in the last 2 years since COVID, there has been a kind of a huge uptick in syndications also. So I think if someone's not super interested in, you know, talking to a broker and talking to a loan officer and talking to an appraiser and a title company and all of that and trying to buy real estate in their name, they can actually also invest in real estate via syndications, right? So I think that's there's a ton of syndications that are happening, I would say, since COVID. I think prior to COVID, maybe they were happening. I just wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
but I see them a lot more often now. I see a lot more people like you and I who are syndicating deals that are open to you know, people.
To be more partnership.
Exactly. Passively invest in apartment communities and homes and many other asset classes.
Yeah. Well, Dershan, thanks so much for being a part of the Wells Way podcast. If people wanted to get a hold of you, how could they do it?
Social media. I'm everywhere. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook, Instagram. I think if someone's really interested, they can check out my Instagram at Real Estate Dershan. I have a website at realestatedershan.com as well. And on LinkedIn, just my name, Dershan Soni, Darshan, last name Soni, Soni. Easy to find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was great.